Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This week's episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast is sponsored by Ashdown Engineering, a British bass amplification powerhouse whose gear is seen on the biggest stages in the world, backing up the biggest bands in the world. But now Ashdown have expanded their expertise into bass guitars. Having teamed up with master luthier Dan Lackin, previously of Lackland Basses, Ashdown are now offering five different models of US-designed basses, from classically inspired shapes to completely new designs, fusing vintage sensibilities with all the modern applications a bassist needs. Available in an ever-expanding range of finishes, and all for under £1,000. These instruments are extremely exciting. Check them out at ashdownmusic.com or follow links in the description of this podcast. Hello and welcome to the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast, a podcast by guitar nerds. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by JD Short.
Hello.
And Naomi McLeod.
Hello, hello.
Yes, yes, we are all back. Welcome back to our bi-weekly Bass Guitar Nerds podcast. We've actually got lots to talk about this week. So, dear listener, we've decided for this week we're going to each talk about a list of bass guitars that we consider to be the best ones in their perspective field. So short scale, fretless, five string, etc. I don't mean a short scale fretless five string. There aren't many of those, but we're going to be going through and seeing how we differ and what we agree on as being the best currently available instruments that you can purchase, with the slight caveat that, you know, I think we should try our best to not go too far into, you know, the world of like £4,000-£5,000 instruments and try and keep it as factory made as possible, in order to keep it, you know, reasonable. But before we do that, Boss have just released the OC5, a pedal that we were talking about the OC2 as being certainly. So Naomi, you like the OC2?
I am an OC2 aficionado. Yes, a traditionalist, you might say.
Exactly, they are fantastic pedals. But JD, not so much. The OC2 doesn't offer the clarity that you like in a pedal. I don't know if we talked about the OC3 much and the sort of the weird. I don't know why it wasn't very good. Like, I don't know how they went from the OC2 to the OC3, introduced like a weird drive circuit that no one wanted a drive to be on the octave as well. You know, if you're using an octave pedal in your setup, you've probably got a drive pedal.
It was a weird addition. Who wanted or needed the drive to be on board?
Yeah, exactly. It was a strange option. And certainly, even on the sort of the polyphonic side of it, I didn't feel that it really tracked quite as well as the OC2. Even though obviously the OC2 can't track polyphonically, but it was always just a little bit of a weird one. So it's wonderful that the OC5 has turned up, and of course this one, like the OC3, which I think had an input for bass and guitar,
Boss of now gone for a little switch at the top, so you can turn it between a bass and a guitar, you know, voicing or whatever, which is pretty good. And they've added an octave up, which isn't so useful for us. Do either of you, would you use an octave up?
I would absolutely use an octave up, and that's one of the things I like about my Mutron octave is that it has the sort of the green ringer switch
right
in it, and I find that with sort of an envelope is it gets you a lot of like really synthy sounds.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, like I would say like the polyphonic mode and the octave up are the things that are making me sort of really really interested in trying the OC5.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of it. It's very, I mean, that's something you've been able to do on a Micropog for, you know, the last 15 years. But it's nice that option's there alongside this vintage mode.
Sure.
The vintage mode essentially has all the things from the OC2 plus the octave up, which, you know, I was just shutting off and then comparing it directly to the OC2 and how it sounded. And I thought it did a really good job of being very, very similar.
Yeah, I think as well with the Pog, I mean, the Pog has always kind of had this characteristic Pog sound that way back to even the first time I heard it and thought, you know, I was so wowed only because I'd never heard anything like the Pog. And certainly on bass, you know, it does create a strong first impression if it's the first of its type that you've heard.
Sure.
Granted, this was a million years ago when I was young, but... yeah, well, I think the great thing that the OC2 and 3 and now 5 have done is remain really transparent sounding. You know, it's just so much cleaner and clearer than the very characteristic recognizable sound of a Pog. Certainly in terms of the octave up, like I definitely would be partial to octave up sound on bass. In fact, I use it sometimes in an albeit wonky setting on my Boss PS6 Harmonist.
Oh, really?
It has a range, but it has fourth, fifth, an octave up and two octaves up, which is decidedly dodgy, I would say. But one octave up is safe enough, you know, it's cool. So I'm super stoked to try the OC5 for the first time and get that sound on the go. And the demos I was listening to earlier, As they've all flooded in on release day, it sounds pretty promising.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely very good. I can see wonderful application for guitarists in this range control, which, weirdly enough, Boss are really pushing the addition of this range control. But the range control was on the OC3. Like, it's not a new thing. I thought it was weird that's like they're like now with a range control. You had this last time, but the idea of the range control is when you're in the polyphonic mode. The range control will control how many strings when you're playing a chord that it applies the octave effects to. So you can turn it right down and just have it supply a root note, which is quite, you know, which is quite nice for guitarists who are bass playerless. But, you know, for us, it doesn't matter so much that range control is relatively irrelevant. My only thing with the OC5 is, why isn't it an OC2W? Now I need to ask Matt that. As in, why is this not a Wazzacraft pedal called the OC2W? Because it's got those two modes, the vintage and the polyphonic mode. Well, what is Wazzacraft if not vintage Boss effects, you know, redone? And the vintage mode is quite specifically an OC2. So I don't understand. Half of this pedal is an OC2, but they're not calling it an OC2W. I just kind of like, man, if you'd have called this the same product, OC2W, they could have slapped another £50 on the price and probably sold more because people would want an OC2W. But as an OC5, it's sort of like they're leading with the polyphonic side of the pedal. And, you know... I think this pedal is very good. Boss do not have a good reputation for their quality sort of polyphonic circuitry. That's not their strong point. So it's, and even though this one is fantastic, I do think this one's very good. It just seems to be leading with your sort of your weaker arm. Like I'm not entirely sure why they've made that decision, more from a marketing perspective than the product. The product itself, I think, is very good.
Sure. How do you remember, or does anyone remember, how long the OC3 has been out, when it was released, what the time frame's been between?
It's been a long time, hasn't it? You think the OC2 came out in 1984, and then I guess the OC3, I feel like it's always been available. Like I wanted to, I didn't play the OC3 because I don't really like it on the video I did of it, but I dug out my OC3 just to have it sort of sitting on the stand.
Sat so you next can see to all, it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think this one OC3 I've had, you know, I guess since, you know, my first or second band. So like 2000, 2001, I think.
Right. So it's, that was what I was thinking, was it early 2000s? So yeah. It's this is long awaited, the OC5, because I mean, really, we the market, as I speak for whole market, have been after the OC2 and its ultimate update for whatever people felt was missed in the OC3, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I feel like Boss are kind of running out of those old pedals now to reissue. And maybe that's their plan. They'll do the OC2W later. But of course, the big sort of after Boss pedals. And I kind of feel like bass players almost have the monopoly on vintage, on sought after vintage Boss pedals. Mm-hmm. Because I think of like the CS2 as like a gorgeous sounding, you know, old messy compressor. The VB2, the OC2, and probably the Dimension C. Those are like, I'm like, oh, these are the ones that you think of as being legendary. And I think the Dimension C, obviously, Chorus is equal parts guitar and bass suitable, but I kind of feel like the VB2, the compressor, and the Octaver are quite bass player orientated pedals.
Yeah, for sure.
But that might actually also just be because I'm really into Juan Aldrete and he uses those pedals, so it is probably that.
Anyway. Like you're a man of good taste.
Yes, there you go. But yeah, there you go, dear listener. So the OC5, I really think it's worth checking out. I mean, I don't think it's reinventing the wheel or anything like that, but it's certainly got some wonderful features that make it you know, a perfect option if you're looking for an Octaver. I think you'd be hard pushed to find something that's got more options on it at the moment for a reasonable sum of money. But yes, we should talk about this list of bass guitars. So I was thinking, I was reading this article on I think in Music Radar that was talking about like Music Radar's top 10. Basses, but it wasn't like 1 to 10. It was like, this is the one we think is the best fretless, this is the one we think is the best, you know, whatever. And I thought that's quite an interesting list. Their choices were very, very predictable, and they were just sort of the obvious one, like the ones that you will see in most guitar shops. And so I started wondering, well, I wonder what the actual best options are for each of us. So I thought I'd split it into five categories: best affordable bass, best short scale bass, best fretless bass, best five string, and then best bass, which is obviously incredibly vague. The caveat is that all of these basses need to be currently produced. We can't be sort of, you know, the best bass is a 1962 precision bass. It has to be something you can currently buy new in a shop. And as much as we can, although, you know, we're being quite lenient with this one, I think we should try and stick to models that you can purchase for the best part in a shop, rather than sort of, you know, if we're you know, talking
custom
about
custom build,
because of course the answer to all of these is a custom build by some one company or another, you know.
But yeah, it would be great if we consult a guy who knows a guy.
Exactly. So we'll kind of take this one at a time and go around the room and we'll talk about each one. And see how that goes. So let's start at number one. Let's start with best affordable bass. And we'll start with you, JD.
Yeah, so just a follow-up question. what does one mean by affordable?
I'll
say sort of like what I was sort of thinking about with it was not necessarily the sort of bare bones, like lowest, like basically the easy, the, like cheapest, but like most reasonable, like 100 quid sort of, that's a bare minimum what you're going to pay to get something that stays in tune
exactly
for at least 10 minutes at a time.
So yeah, carry on.
No, you go ahead. Go ahead.
So I, yeah, exactly that. I was thinking, you know, yes, best affordable base. We could talk about Affinity Squire, sure, but they're not, you know, they probably are, like, if you've got £150 to spend on an instrument, but I kind of feel like it needs to be affordable, I guess, the top end of that, like £400-450, man. I know that's not incredibly affordable, but I think that's really the first time that these are going to be fantastic instruments.
Yeah.
And it's like something that you can actually use, not something you can give a beginner. But what's the best affordable base? I almost mean, what's the least amount of money you can spend on something that will literally be fantastic? I think that's the angle.
Yeah, so I think sort of what I've almost always advised people of for decades now is the same as would be my go-to. This, what I would probably get in this range would be the Yamaha BB-234, which is the PJ Yamaha four-string that's out there that I always feel like, certainly at the lower end, there's always so much about Yamaha that is, like, quality is consistent across everything they do. Like, I used to work in a piano store, and the Yamaha pianos were always some of my favorites in each price point. And then so, like, just seeing those with basses, there's just something I feel like they play a little bit sleeker. And there's something about the tone that is a little more, it's a little richer. Like the bass end of the spectrum is more rounded, and the top end is more clarion. Like it's more piercing without being brittle.
Yeah.
And I think it's just like, you know, like value wise, I think that's sort of, they're one of my favorite, like most assured purchases out there.
Yeah, they're like around £300.
Yeah, three fifty, depending on what you're kind of looking at.
And another great thing about that series, the two series of BBs, is that there's a massive range of colors, which is very good. I mean, it being a PJ, this is a great thing for an affordable bass to be, because it's versatile. I really like this whole this reinvention of the BB series. I think they were really good, coming on from the 424 and was it 414, 424, and then I can't remember the expensive ones.
There's a 734.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I went through a period of being obsessed with BB basses when I was obsessed with Billy Sheehan, which I still am a bit. He's still very, very good. But I bought he had a signature BB model, which was very good. And I owned a couple of vintage ones, and I owned a couple of 424s, and Yamaha actually called me in for the design, the sort of R&D side of this series, the BB-234s and everything that's come in that model.
Wow, that's hella cool.
Yeah, it was really cool. I got to sort of go, you know, just to this place in London, and then they just had a bunch of bass players, and they asked us what we wanted. We had a room full of basses of other brands, and they wanted us to play those and talk about what we thought should be the changes. And it was, I wasn't then contacted again, you know, and obviously I just saw these come out. And one of the things, a few things that were really lovely that I think they took note that were things I was saying. I'm sure other players were saying them as well. I'm not saying they've done this because of me, but they certainly were my main points, was get away from the Yamaha sized PJ pickups that they were using on the previous series, so you couldn't retrofit your own pickups.
Sure, yeah.
And it's great that on the 200 series, well, on all of the new Yamaha BBs, they've gone for conventional sort of Fender, you know, size PJs so that you can upgrade this instrument with you as you move. And one of the other things was move away from like standardized colors, because those 414s and 424s were all like white, red, black, sunburst. You know, it's just the standard collection. And they had some really interesting finishing ideas in the new Yamaha stuff.
I really like the teal in the new one that they brought out is so tasty.
Yes, the teal was very good. The entire series is kind of fantastic across the board. I didn't even think about these when I was thinking about mine, JD. This is a fantastic choice.
Well, excellent. Thank you. I'm excited to hear what y'all's think.
Yeah. okay. So, Naomi, your favorite. What do you think is the best affordable bass guitar?
Well, I've had to make a mini list within my list, thanks to JD, because I had a BB234 down there too.
Really? That's fantastic, though.
It is. I mean, two votes for BB, right? But I genuinely did, because I know I've, since joining the podcast, I've talked quite a bit about Fender and Squire, and you know, I'm very unashamed in my very traditional tastes towards those. But I thought for the purposes of this list, as a mini personal challenge, it might be nice to double check what else I'm feeling out there. So the other one I had was the Sterling Sub Stingray 4, sitting under the £400 mark.
They are very good. Had a
few of those come by the last store I worked in, and I really enjoyed watching them come in and go straight back out. And again, you know, they fulfill the criteria of a super nice range of finishes. They do I don't know what they call it. It's sort of like a Fiesta Red. They do their version of, I think they do call it Fiesta or Fire Red.
Yeah. Is that on the classic version of the sub? Is that right?
I think it might be even cheaper actually than the ones I'm looking at, or it could be by finish. But the Fiesta Red one I saw, I mean, that's literally around, it's about £329. You'll see it online. But yeah, I mean, the spec is, there's nothing too wild going on there. They've got the classic pickup. They've got a basswood body, maple necks, and then with rosewood and maple options in the fingerboard. But I mean, they'll just pack that Stingray punch.
Well, that's it. How do you, have you ever owned a Stingray?
I haven't owned a proper Stingray. I have owned, my first ever bass was a vintage Stingray copy, would you believe?
Right.
So tonally, I guess I sort of grew up with that kind of very much bouncing around my ears, that that more classic tone. But no, I've only been lucky to play some really nice Stingrays.
I've always found it to be like the most Marmite of all the sort of bass pickup configurations you can have. That big sort of often active eight-pole humbucker in the bridge.
Yeah, it is controversial for sure. It's not for everyone. It's not the most transparent sounding bass. If you were to, I mean, we could probably do a whole episode on what constitutes a transparent sounding bass, right? But in terms of the more classic tones that we've heard, of the, you know, the P and the J type, it does bring something different to the table for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. JD, have you ever owned one?
I've never owned a Stingray, and part of it, I wanted one very badly, mostly early Flea, post what was he, play Spectre, Flea, and then one of my sort of early bass big brothers that I looked up to had, I think it was a mid-late 70s Stingray in Butterscotch with a Tort pickguard, and it was with maple fretboard, and it was amazing. And then another friend of mine had a Stingray with sort of standard with like a rosewood board, and I would play it when we were over at his house, and it just never really could sit with me right, you know. And it was like, so much of what I liked at the time was very Stingray-ish, and it just didn't really fit with me. I will say though, the newer Stingrays they came out with a couple years ago, the ones that are smaller and lighter.
Yeah.
I really, really liked those in like a way that it never made me sort of, that sort of like piqued my interest in a way that it hadn't done for a long time.
Do you think it was because of the body reshaping? Because they made them slightly lighter, thinner. It's a slightly smaller frame because they do weigh a ton. Those like a big old ash, you know, Stingray.
Yeah, it must be like there's always something around like the playability for me was never really there. And like Lewis Johnson always played Stingray. You know, like so many classic things that I really like are Stingray, but it was. You know, again, kind of as we were talking about, I think it was they were one of the first like mass market, active, big, bold, bass in your face sort of basses.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it was like, I think by the time I was sort of into that, there was so many more options that had been redefined and like refined in ways that made more sense to me. But I love them. I've never found the right one for me.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. I guess that's kind of the thing with the Stingray. I think you do have to. They have changed so much that I think there is a Stingray sound. I think it varies from kind of model to model and iteration to iteration, like quite a lot. Naomi, what made you like not carry on pursuing Stingrays then? If your first instrument was one of them, why didn't you graduate onto an actual one? What made you move on to different pickup configurations?
I became aware a few years further into my extremely youthful hazy bass forays of a certain instrument known as the Fender Jazz Bass, Joe.
Right.
And
I
you
see.
Could say I never looked back.
Right.
Well, you know, interestingly, my first ever bass, that same Stingray copy, was a 5-string as well. Uh-huh. I was, what can I say, I was listening to an awful lot of Korn around this time. it was going to go Ibanez or Stingray copy as it ended up. I mean, yeah, I suppose I just wanted to focus my playing and my learning and I suppose my style into something a little more... a little more on the straight and narrow, and thus a jazz bass kind of made sense as a slightly more versatile instrument to move on with.
Right.
I still to this day think Stingrays are monsters of tone. You know, like you guys are saying, that huge, active, boomy tone, I still think is mighty, but in my personal experience, I've just been able to use the jazz bass for more and to especially as on my personal playing journey, I've kind of ended up going down, you know, the bassist for hire kind of route of potentially using the same bass several times in a week for completely different gigs. And while I've seen, you know, obviously there are incredible players out there doing the same and using their Stingrays in very versatile ways, it just hasn't been for me.
Yeah.
But it's not to say that it's not an awesome instrument, and I do stand by my affordable choice for what it's worth. Absolutely would recommend the Sub Stingray 4 for anyone looking around in that lower end market.
They are very good. You're absolutely right, and I think those Stingrays are made by Cort for Sterling Music Man, and I've got a lot of time for that brand. I think they make fantastic quality stuff at the price point they turn stuff out, and I agree with you. I think it's a fantastic affordable instrument. Now, as we've had kind of a PJ and we've had a Stingray style pickup, I'm glad that mine's going to be something slightly different, because I was thinking, and you know, I'm surprised this hasn't come up, although I think it's testament to Yamaha that kind of that both of you were sort of leaning towards those ones. But I was sure I'd be pipped to the post on this. Sire, the Sire Marcus Millers,
their new
V7 jazz basses. The version, yes, it's V7 is the range. It's version 2, isn't it? It's their upgraded version
Mark 2.
The Mark II, yes, of the V7s, which is their jazz bass series. I had a friend who bought, you know, one of the 5-strings and was like, I this is as good as my, he is his, you know, five string Fender Deluxe or whatever he was playing at the time. And, you know, having sat down with them, I'm like, yeah, I can't believe the quality that they're turning out. I love the kind of ethic behind Marcus Miller and what he was trying to achieve with these guitars. The fact that Sire approached him and he was very much like, well, I'm not doing it to slap my name on it. We have to make it very good. And he specifically moved away from Fender because he didn't like that his signature model was £800-900. And he wanted to have an instrument that kids could play. And that was the idea behind the V7s, certainly. And
that is very cool, both from a business and from an ethical point of view. Because, you know, if you're going to put your name to something, you do just want to get as many people as possible playing your instrument, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it just feels like there are no cut corners on these.
Yeah.
You know, you've for got. Sure. It's like a four band EQ on the bass. Plus, you've got active passive switching, which is something that Fender don't offer on their Mexican active range. You have to go to American active to actually get an active passive switch on a Fender. So they introduced all of that. Plus, it's an 18 volt preamp on the V7s. So these things sound absolutely incredible, substantial bass. And the great thing was with the new ones that are available now mine are a little bit more expensive than yours because I'm coming in at £415, which is right on the edge of what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But they released one in Burgundy Mist.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now, thinking of you. It all makes sense. Yeah,
there you go.
It's beautiful looking. Look They're at great. That. All of their appointments are, you know, you just like... Still, I mean, I'm unsurprised by this second gen kind of living up to the big splash that the first generation made. But I mean, the neck inlays, the perloid pickguard. Is it a sparkle finish, the burgundy?
It's a metallic finish rather than sort of
it's
sparkle,
metallic. But yeah, but it I mean, it looks every bit as good as sparkle. It might just be the photos I'm looking at here on online. But it's, I mean, yeah, their finishes are every bit as good as basses, three times the price.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Matching headstock, as you say, like rosewood neck with big perloid block inlays. Like, this is the sort of, when you come to the aesthetics, this is the sort of thing that you won't see until custom shop on Fenders, like colour options like that with cool appointments like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That plus sort of the versatility of the active passive, the switching options, you know, you've essentially got an entire amp head on the front of your bass when it comes to tone shaping. I even think the headstock's okay, and I think I'm sure that these are being sold by the absolute boatload, because you know why would you buy a Fender alternative at this price point where you get so much more bang for your buck. From the Sires. I think they are extremely good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm just looking through the range here and it's making me remember the first time. I don't know, when did those first ranges come out? Was it five years ago?
About five-ish, it feels, yeah.
Yeah, like 2015. I still remember my first time hearing one being gigged and thinking that, you know, this literally sounds like American Deluxe good.
Yeah.
And that is insane. And I remember going up to my friend who was playing it and, you know, asking him how much he'd paid and, you know, was it true that this range was really kind of all in the, well, euro in my case, you know, 400 to 600-700 euro range. And the splash that they made among kind of bassist groups on Facebook, and I'm sure for you guys as well, Guitar Nerds, just this kind of delighted disbelief of what we were seeing kind of hit the market. And like you're saying, in terms of just seeing those appointments that you really don't see elsewhere in any product range, on the bigger market anyway, at this price point.
Yeah.
It's, what is not to love, I would ask.
Exactly. They are, really, really good. And I hope they continue. But yes, so there you go.
Cool.
Best affordable bass. I think those are some great options. If not a little predictable, maybe, but I think affordable bass is are going to be, you know, well, our decisions are
just with, I know we're wanting to wrap up. I just want to say, like, I had the first thought was when it was like affordable, it's like, oh, well, Sire. I feel like that's probably the answer. I do want to give another shout that one of the other ones I thought about thinking that is probably less predictable was the Steinberger Spirit, like the XT series that you can get, which is the little, headless wedge bodied basewood, maple.
Such a ridiculous choice.
Yeah. That,
super predictable.
That's one of those things that's like always. I had one ages and ages ago, and I don't have it anymore because I lost a piece, and it was back when the hardware was. It would have cost me 3 times the amount to get piece like parts for it than it would to get it because there's no reverb. There's probably wasn't even eBay then, and yeah, it was just one of those things where I got rid of it. But yeah, like thinking about it, I was like, yeah, that's another one that I'd be like, yeah, I'd get this, and I would play it a lot. So that was my other shout to make it less predictable.
They're definitely great. I think they come with their own gig bags, even at that price point.
Yeah,
which you know, it looks like a sort of a fishing rod soft case. Those Steinbergers, but they are very, very good. I found them a bit hit and miss. I remember when we had them.
Speaking of Marmite, you know, they are definitely a Marmite choice, but yeah, I think it's...
Yeah.
At least you won't get your gig bags mixed up at the side of the stage, though, right?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah,
well,
yeah, exactly.
Well, not with, you know, other bassists and guitarists, but maybe the lighting person or, you know,
sure.
Like, or just, you know, a janitor or
something.
Bunch
of mic stands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's good to live on the edge.
Yeah, I've never owned one. I've often thought about it, but as I get older and inevitably fatter, I require large body bases to hide the beer belly, and so you know, smaller bodies they're just gonna
just put like a big beard on it or like a some sort of drape a cloth like underneath it.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Just play from behind a drape with the arms and bass in front.
Yeah,
I
like
would
backlit.
Say.
Of course.
Yeah.
A sheet in front of you, backlit, just your silhouette.
That's
and it's a place for your face. So like you could have so you can, you know, you can still pull
I
faces
think
and stuff.
I'm moving more towards this as an idea. I think that's inevitably where I'm going to end up. But that, you know, it's okay. For now, I can rely on these big body basses. Anyway... Let's talk about short scale basses. So the best short scale basses. Naomi, why don't you start this one?
Well, after my earlier boast about trying to stay away from Fender, we're going to go straight back to Fender, and I'm going to tell you my short scale bass choice is among the nicest basses I've played in the last few years is the JMJ Mustang. So Justin Meldal Johnson signature Mustang that came out a little while ago, 2 years ago, was it a 2018 release?
Like
comes in just under the £1,000 mark, probably a little over in dollars. But yeah, it is a relict. Is it like plastic blue or is it turquoise?
No, it's is it like plastic blue? I guess it is like plastic blue, yeah.
I need to double check that.
It's
but
also it's, available in black, though. It was for a limited edition run. And they actually did a limited run in Firemus Gold as well. Always in the... Because it's like a road-worn relic. It's of that standard, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's not unlike the Shell Pink Flea signature that we saw. Signature Flea Jazz Bass. But yeah, so relic and indeed road worn means straight out the box, it's got that worn in feel. Meaning the two that I got to play that I saw come through a store just both felt so easy, so enjoyable to play from the neck. In hand, it's got a C profile neck, super lightweight.
Came strung with flats, didn't it?
It did come strung with flats, or does, that is true. Yeah, and just kind of pleasantly aged in every way. You've got lollipop tuners on there as well.
Such a nice touch.
You've got an aged perloid pickguard and the perloid fret dots. So, yeah, I mean, going straight back to appointments, it's kind of one that certainly fit all my criteria. I know road worn isn't for everyone. Relic, indeed, is I don't know, is it becoming more contentious? But a lot of people are kind of, I see a lot of people kind of sniffing at the idea of purchasing a relict instrument, you know, purchasing something that looks pre-wrecked. Is it pretentious? Yeah. I don't see it as any different to how fashionable distressed clothes have been over the years. You know, if you like something visually, absolutely don't let it stop you. If it's also an instrument that sounds fantastic and feels great to play thanks to its worn-in-ness.
Yeah.
But yeah, for a short scale, I mean, I'm a huge short scale fan anyway.
I was very interested to hear what you come up with for this, because for you, this must have been very difficult to sort of narrow it down to one.
Well, considering Best Bass was on our list, I will say a short scale just fell in there by accident, on purpose by accident. So we can leave that to later, or I can bunch mine together and then give you guys the time later. So
I want to hear that when it comes round. Okay,
sure,
that's fine. They're absolutely fantastic basses. I mean, Mustangs are really, really good. JD, have you ever owned a Mustang?
I have not owned a Mustang.
Do you not like them? Is it a deliberate not liking, or is it just not something you've ever been interested in?
It's really not something I've just had much experience with. And it's only sort of been probably in the last few years that I've sort of been intrigued by them. And just sort of like any short scale bass in general. And, you know, a lot of it is that they weren't, when I was still, you know, like in music shops every day, it felt like they weren't in production really.
Yeah.
So it wasn't
anything
you would see. And I spent most of my time having like one main bass, you know, and so like, it's either been like the custom build I had done, you know, like ages ago, or it's sort of, and then so then they always sort of felt like more like playthings more than, which is totally fine and acceptable, and I would love to have one now. I haven't had the time with them that I would like to have.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Fair enough. I think Mustangs are amongst the most playable short scale basses. They definitely feel the most different. I don't know if you find this, Naomi, but because Fender have stuck to that the horn over the 12th fret thing, it pulls the neck in so much closer than other short scales, because, you know, normally short scales have more of a like a Gibson-y aesthetic, which means that neck's naturally further away from you, so it doesn't feel that much different from a 34-inch scale. But with the Mustang, everything's really close in.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it is that bit harder to play a Mustang, I find, than a 34-inch. But yeah, that's something that I personally enjoy by way of how it modifies the playing, how it modifies writing, and performing as well. Like it, you know, it's a hugely different feel to perform on Especially if, like in my case, where at one point in one previous band, I was swapping between a Mustang and a jazz bass and a P bass in the one set, because yes, I was that pretentious. we were using three different tunings. We were in standard, sure, drop D, and I think CG, CG. Needless to say, the Mustang was not the one in CG, CG.
Well, that's JD, you say short scale basses weren't around. I think it was partly that. And also, I'm kind of the same. I've only come around to short scale basses recently. And I feel like that's with the reason for that is how easy custom strings, like we talked about Norton strings and the other week. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of that has changed things for me, because the problem with short scales is all the strings are like 40 to 100. And it's, I certainly can't get into D standard on 40 to 100. It's not, not with sort of being able to play with any speed, because their strings will be hanging off, off the bass.
Your dexterity's out the window with the wrong gauge on, even on the right bass, isn't it?
Exactly. So now that you can basically order whatever string you want, from plenty of custom shops out there, then it's just made short scales kind of an option, which is nice. But yes, I totally agree. The JMJ Mustang is absolutely fantastic. I can't believe it's not a custom shop. It feels, looks, and plays like a custom shop, and it's £1,000 is very good indeed.
Yeah. Faded Daphne Blue, by the way, was...
That was what it was.
The colour we saw. I had Sonic Blue swimming around my head, which was... Faded Sonic Blue came back in with the PJ Mustang release that they did in 2017.
I bought one of those. In that colour. It's very good.
That's funny.
Oh, is that the one you had? Oh, I thought you had the white one. Oh, right.
Yeah, no, I had the faded blue. I did sell it on, and then obviously eventually got the Bronco on the go. Do you still have your PJ?
I sold it on, but I will say, like, when I had it, it was for recording the best bass I almost owned. Like, the PJ made it versatile. The short scale made it playable. As much as I'm a sucker for vintage stuff, certainly if anyone ever has to see me, I want to be playing something vintage, but I do appreciate when I'm behind closed doors, I do appreciate an unfinished neck. It does make things a bit quicker and easier, and I just thought everything about those PJ Mustangs was unbelievably good for the price point. For me, it nearly won short scale. It hasn't for me. It nearly won short scale and nearly won best affordable, because they're like £350 or whatever. Or are they a bit more? Maybe that's the second hand price.
I think they might be a bit more. Yeah, it was about $599 when I bought mine. I think they might have come down close to the five mark.
But yeah, they are absolutely brilliant. And you see them all over the place. And I think they're a wonderful base for getting people into bases. And kind of, and then Fender did a great job of being like, we'll do one in shell pink. We'll do one in butterscotch with a black plate. Like, we'll do one in Fire Mist Gold. They did them in all these cool colours that got people coming back for more of them. It was just a, I don't know for why sure. this one hasn't won everything. But
yeah, no, I think was it the second run they did? Because I remember it was Faded Sonic Blue, Olympic White, and Torino Red first, I believe. Yeah. But then the second run, they did a Capri Orange. And boy, did I regret not waiting and getting one in Capri Orange, because it looked very good indeed.
It really did.
They
were absolutely fantastic. A friend of the podcast, Charlie Ralphs, who used to work with all of the other Guitar Nerds team at GAC, she is obsessed with Mustangs and also with pink things, and she has a massive collection of sort of Music Masters and Mustangs. And I think, I'm not sure she bought that PJ in every color, but it definitely the orange was one of them. And it was very frustrating for her when Fender released new colors in that bass, because it was £500, and it was absolutely spot on.
Yeah, it's the trouble of being really into a model that you've just bought that is current model with Fender, isn't it? They're probably around the corner from releasing it in an even cooler color.
Yeah, exactly. JD, let's talk short scales.
Yeah, so I was initially going to go straight for the Nordstrom Ascena Knicks, which we've talked about.
Oh, yeah.
But then with the caveat, or catveat, of being available in a shop, which I think those likely are, but are harder to get. So thinking like bigger availability. Also the same thing I was thinking about Sarek. So then kind of coming back to this. So what I ended up going for, also leaving off Alembic and Status bases as, you know, we've ruled those out. Otherwise, those would be up there as well. I picked the, which I think you can still, well, you can definitely still get it, but the Epiphone Alan Woody Rumblecat.
Oh, yes. Another base that I have owned. But yes, tell us about the Rumblecat.
Yeah, so the Rumblecat, it's 30-inch scale length, and is, I'd have to think about it. It's one of those bases I've played and was like...
Just, I thought it was 32. So,
is it 32?
I thought it was 32, yeah.
Yeah.
Either way, that still counts as short scale.
Yeah, less than 34 inches.
Yeah.
It's 30 on the listing here.
Oh, it's 30, really?
Yeah.
God.
Yeah.
I also I apologize.
I also just love it that these only come in wine red, which is just great. And that, so with them, they're also, I think, what, roughly around 400-450 quid, I think. Yeah, so set neck, mahogany, ironwood, pow ferro fingerboard, which is also what I have on my my custom build.
Oh, really?
And, you know, it's just like everything, you get the traditional, like, you know, like Epiphone floating bridge, two pickups, and then I can't remember what all it's three. I think it's volume, tone, or something like that on the for the controls. But it's just such a nice. I mean, it's not the most versatile instrument, I don't think. You know, like it's
two mini humbuckers, one in the neck and one in the middle, which is definitely a very specific tone.
Yeah, well, and it's also just. Yeah, it is a big, boomy, gnarly beast of a sound. But
yeah,
it's sort of the things where I think, like, if they weren't Epiphone, like the Rumblecat and the Jack Cassidy bass, you know, like, I think if there were, you know, like, if some other company made those and it wasn't seen as, like, a baby Gibson kind of thing, like, I think they would probably sell three times as much, because like those bases for me are just such great, they're such great value, and they don't have a ton of competition in like what they do, you know, for how much you get them for.
Absolutely. I thought that the Rumblecat was so much bang for its buck to have this lovely like chambered sort of Les Paul shape, but with like a 335 ear on the on the lower horn, like unusual pickup placement, and for the price point it was incredible. At the time I was going through a weird phase in my life where I was playing a I'd bought a Gibson Custom Shop Memphis made a Gibson Custom Shop Memphis made hollow Les Paul bass, short scale,
yes.
Gold top. Did either of you remember this? It was something that they did make available for a little while. I paid so much money for that bass.
Yeah,
I don't know. Was that? And I needed a second one, obviously, just for gigs in case something went wrong. And I bought the Rumblecat, and I ended up playing the Rumblecat more than I was the Les Paul bass, just because it was just a little bit more versatile, and I guess I was less afraid to throw it around, and it, you know, it felt less likely to break.
Sure. Was this the Les Paul bass with F holes? ES Actually, Les Paul.
I did the like the YouTube advert for Boss for their for the Dimension C chorus, and I played that bass for that video. They had really specific criteria when I turned up at the studio, and they were like, they'd called me knowing sort of my ridiculous collection. They were like, we really want you to play something that people own, you know. Don't bring a weird custom shop, you know. Like, don't bring a weird sort of, don't bring the Stonefield, was I think what they were saying. Like, they were like, you need to have something that is normal for, like, you know,
market applicable.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I turned up with a short scale hollow body Gibson, and my excuse was, I was like, well, Gibson are a main brand, you know, everyone knows Gibson. And yeah, notice that I'm in about 5 seconds of that advert now.
I absolutely love that. That's like the bull in a china shop equivalent of show up with something classic, please.
Yeah. It was definitely a mistake, but
which probably, had they not mentioned something beforehand, you would have just been there with like a jazz bass or like a P bass. You know, probably, you would have brought a P bass and been like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was
in drop F or something.
Yeah, that was there was. I mean, also I turned up with a bass like strung with flats to do a video demo for a chorus pedal. Like, it's something that really requires treble to kind of work well. So it's, I don't think they were very happy with me. Actually, that's the last time they employed me.
Oh dear.
So I wonder if that's maybe put two and two together.
But we love Boss. One. Boss are very cool. Awesome. Yes. Boss.
Yes, Boss, our boss. Well, yeah, I think the Rumblecat is a very cool choice.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. I have chosen the Godin Dorchester.
Oh, nice.
Are you aware of the Godin Dorchester, JD?
Just Godin is such a good shout.
Oh, that's such a good.
Just like they're one of those ones I always feel like are under the radar, and everything I've ever played by them is just solidly good.
Yeah, that's exactly what I think about them. They're so good, but they're totally under the radar. Like, I almost felt when I was looking through their range of basses, I was like, man, I could literally choose them for every category here. But the Dorchester for me was something that really stood out, and I was very excited about when they released it, because it is a Moss Wright style body shape, but they've very much given it their own edge. They've changed those horns. There's something slightly SG-esque about the horns on the top, but it's still that offset body. It's just gorgeous. It's a perfect looking, sleek, cool retro instrument.
This is also now just making me hang my head, because what I had thought earlier was the Reverend Mike Watt for short scale, but this is like giving me similar
more on that
vibes
later.
As far as that, yeah.
Yeah, it's very good, and probably the only other company to be doing B90s.
Literally was just gonna say, are these two base P90
shapes?
Yeah,
they are the Godin Passive Kingpin Dog-Eared Alnico bass pickups, as they are catchily awesome. Named.
I'm super curious to hear this. It's not a bass I've seen before. Am I right in thinking, Joe, that so Godin are like, they're the same are they under the same parent as like Seagull and Art and Luthery?
That's
and,
correct. Yeah. All the same.
Because the little bit I heard about these guys was really awesome in terms of ethical wood farming and sourcing and all that sort of stuff. So they seem to have a lot going on besides their brilliant building. I mean, Godin, I think, are kind of most well known for a lot of their acoustic products, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and they have, I just wonder if maybe, because they're a Canadian company, so it might be like, I have seen them maybe in the wild a bit more, but like I've been in bands with some people that have played them, and or I've had like friends that have had like acoustics and stuff that are always around, and it's that same sort of, they always sound much richer than you would expect them to sound, certainly for the price you usually get them for.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the thing. The problem with Godin is, for me, is you don't see them over here, not nearly as much as I imagine you saw them back in the States.
Yeah.
And
I mean, they're still pretty, it's pretty rare, but it's like if I saw one, I'd be like, oh, interesting. It wouldn't be like, oh yeah, you've got one of those, you know?
So. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, they've kind of, their range of instruments across the board, like their jazzes and their PJ style instruments, are I mean, it's such a difficult thing to do when you want to make a jazz or a precision, to give your instrument an edge and make it look like a Fender but not look like a Fender. I actually think they nailed it on their models, their shifters and their Passion, which is the two models. I really like the shape. It's original, but, you know, Fender-y enough to be recognisable. And it, I feel like they've done the same sort of style of modifications on the Dorchester, in that they've taken a classic shape but made it new and different and interesting and cool. But they go for like about $1,000, which is a very reasonable sum of money for something that unique and cool. And I just, I end up thinking about it an awful lot.
Very cool. Have you got to play one?
I have not. I keep thinking about buying one, but I've just got. I have two custom shops on the go at the moment, and, you know, that are being built and slowly paid for, and I can't add anything more to this at the moment, which is very problematic.
It sounds up.
So we're not, dear listener, we're not going to be able to complete this list, as JD predicted before we started. We're not going to be able to predict this list. You guys want to do one more? Should we do one more? And then we'll finish the other two next week.
I'm up for one more.
So what should we do? We've got to choose. What, do we go straight for best bass?
I'm conflicted because I feel like we either do one more or we sort of talk about all the ones that we didn't get a chance to talk about already in the categories that we wanted to talk about. But yeah, I think we do one more.
Okay.
Yeah, I've very badly hinted at and tried to hide my input. So maybe
we leave best based for next time, because then people will have forgotten.
All right.
And but people will just be annoyed at me then, because I've talked already about my best bass.
That is true. Okay. All right. Well, let's jump ahead. Let's do best bass, and then fretless and five string we can do next week. Because this is a big one. Actually, maybe, oh God, no, this is not good. I'm sorry, this is not good podcasting, dear listener. Best bass is such a big category that it will be the length of this podcast again. So you're right. Let's stay away from that, and let's deal with best fretless bass. It definitely has the least options of any of our categories when it comes to being available at the moment. You know, certainly I remember when I was back at GAC, we would have maybe three fretless instruments available at any one time to sort of the other, you know, 300 basses we had on display in the bass department. But yes, okay, fretless basses. Let's kick things off then. Let's kick things off with you, JD.
So before we had the available in a shop currently made, I was trying to think about sort of what's there, and I was really thinking about what I would look for in a fretless, and really there's sort of two ways to go with it. It feels like the sort of more acoustic-y vibe, sort of fretless, sort of going that route, which oddly enough I have a pick that was by the same company you just mentioned. Or it was sort of the more hi-fi sound, which was, you know, some sort of very epoxied graphite fingerboarded thing. And initially I thought of a Padula Penta. Well, Penta, the five-string one, but the Penta Buzz was what I was thinking, which is...
Fantastic instruments.
Yeah.
They are available in shops, though.
Yeah, but also he just retired last year.
Really?
So technically... Wow. Probably not available.
Oh my God, those basses are going to be going up in price if he's not making them anymore. I need to jump on that now. I mean, they're already like $5,000 a pop.
Yeah, I mean, that being the other bit. And then, so I was kind of thinking like a modulus or some sort of other variant of it, or something with a graphite or ebonol sort of fingerboard, or some sort of plasticky wood one. But I'm going to shift from all of that and go with the Godin A4, which is their hollow body fretless bass. that has the, it's the one that has the big like thumb rest all the way down, you know, like the entire playing area.
So you can choose where to rest your thumb.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not just for that reason, but I think they're, that's probably, aside from, you know, like that's just going to be a nice classic instrument that would work for anything, you know, probably less great for metal, probably less great for some other stuff. But I think that's such a good, you know, I think it's about one, like 1400 pounds or something like that. Yeah. I think is about what you can get in a shop. So, you know, like reasonable production price for those. Yeah. And it also keeps it from me not picking the same thing for the next two categories.
And do they have, is it just the lace sensor that they have in the bridge, or does it also have a piezo? I think it is just a,
I think it's just the lace sensor. Yeah. So I mean, I'll say this, like I have piezos in my, that custom build that I use, but I have them on, but like the, I find certainly with acoustics, like this, the sound is a very specific sound, and I feel like magnetics just work.
Right.
Just magnetics now work so much nicer. And, you know, unless you're playing like a nylon string or something, but it's, I find if you're playing an electric bass, the piezos usually, they're nice to have, but I almost always rely on the magnetic more than anything.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I think piezos are wonderful as something that you can blend with.
Yeah.
They do become difficult on their own. I do disagree when it comes to fretless. I do think piezos can work on their own well, but it's a very specific application, I think, on a fretless bass. Certainly, the biggest problem for me with piezos is how badly they deal with any effects. Which makes it kind of limited. If you want to sound very traditional, they can be fantastic, but outside of that, they are tricky. But yes, good. Nice to see Godin getting some representation.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Naomi, awesome. Fretless bass.
Interestingly, I really went 50-50 on this. So I do have two models. I just couldn't keep it to one. But I'll tell you the first. The first, I stumbled upon in a YouTube, let's call it a Y hole, a rabbit hole of YouTube. I forget even what I was looking at, to be honest, or looking for, as is often the way in my gear demo perusing. But I stumbled upon this some time ago. It's the Ibanez 705 SRF.
Yes.
Comes in, yeah, do you know the one?
I do, very well. It was nearly my choice as well.
Oh, well, cool. Well,
the 705 is the one with loads of frets, even though they're not frets, right?
Yeah, it's a super, it is a super long neck on that. Is it a 24 fret equivalent? I think it might be. I need to double check that. But it's the Okume body. And on the unusual wood continuation, a Panga Panga fretboard.
Nice.
Which I found out is a cousin of Wenge.
There you go.
So yeah, but I think we've talked about it before. I'm a sucker for Okume bodies. I think it's an absolutely stunning tone wood. And it was, I think I might even have been doing something else, like had Ableton open or something, and this demo came on and I just thought this sounds absolutely fantastic. And I took down the
Is it Bartolini's?
It is. It's two Bartolini MK1s you've got on there. And yeah, I mean, well under the £1,000 price mark. You're talking about £850. But yeah, stunning range, super versatile tonally as well. You can get kind of more gnarly and pokey or be super resonant and woody and subby in your tone.
I'm surprised you didn't go for the SRH instead.
The SRH. So what is the difference with the SRH again?
The SRH was their piezo-loaded hollow body one, but they made it a deeper. They made the body deeper because it's a you know, a semi-hollow instrument, and it is just a piezo. But
yes.
I kind of feel like the SRH was what they moved to after the, even though the SRF is still current, the SRF has been in their catalog for a long time. The SRH was their kind of newer thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think for me, I really liked the SRH because I don't like that SR body shape.
No, that is the one thing that I wouldn't have been fond on is visually, but obviously...
To quote Mark Packham, it looks like a sucked sweet, which is... It looks like someone's sucked the guitar. Oh, that sounds... Okay. Yeah, that's what it looks like. It just is too... It looks like it's been in a wind cave thing.
So, you know, this is the one they called the Portamento, wasn't it? The 705.
Yes.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So that's a good shout, because that was the 30 fret equivalent neck or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like it was like 2.5 octave.
Yeah.
That's
huge.
That's
range.
The right answer. That's a good shout.
It's very good. Do you know Bass the World, the YouTube channel? You know that I can never remember his name. The bearded fella who does a lot of their playing. He's an incredible player. I can't remember his name.
I remember
him playing that the SRF, and I was like, oh yeah, that's he makes it work. Like it was always when that instrument came in, I was like, why has a fretless bass got this many frets? You know, neck length. But it's I definitely agree, it's a fantastic sounding instrument. And that's the thing about Ibanez. They're so good at that price point, at like affordable style. Here's an affordable bass. What we've got in there? Oh, Nordstrands. Oh, Bartolini's.
Yeah.
You know, what's it made of? Oh, yeah, Akume. Yeah. Oh, you want Bold Poplar? You know.
Yeah, like those are pretty good appointments for that price range in an already unusual category.
Yeah.
Or an already more niche category with fretless. You know.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. My second choice, just to super quickly sneak it in there, was well off the beaten track. I don't know, are either of you familiar with the Takamine TB10?
Yeah.
Does that ring any bells?
No.
It's a hybrid fretless bass, upright bass. Basically, if you imagine a jumbo. Yeah.
Oh, it's awesome.
Yeah.
If you imagine a jumbo body with an extendable spike so it can be stood up.
Yes.
Everything is arched. You've got a
no. It's £2,000.
It's too. But hey, you know, I managed to sneak it in there under the 4,000.
I think if this had been affordable, I would have clicked by now.
I think this is a great trick, because like it was so hard for me to like not just be like, well, it's going to be my an NS upright. It'd be my the best fretless bass. But like, oh yeah, this is great.
It's so cool.
So good.
So,
listener, you have to check this out. The TB10. I mean, yeah. I don't know.
It's also
Red
Stain fretless. That's what it's called. Red Stain.
You can get it, by the looks of it, you can get it in a... Oh, no, yeah, it is just called Red Stain. Yeah, you're right.
I just think that's such a good name. Like, no.
I need, to find an affordable alternative of this instrument.
I'm just now trying to think of things I don't like about it, and I'm...
There's nothing I don't like about it. It's like,
never go to a page that has buy now.
I know. Well, let's see. Is it okay? Well, the page I'm looking at least for you guys to know, it's 14 to 18 weeks. So that's plenty of time to think about
how much.
Yeah, just how much you need it. But just to come back to some of its appointments, they're really like a kind of a high-end acoustic guitar. You've got maple back and sides and a Sitka spruce top. It sounds huge. It sounds so big. It sounds every bit as powerful to an acoustic ear as a double bass when played horizontally, like an electric bass, or in this case like an electroacoustic bass. It calls itself semi-resonant, so it very much is kind of hybrid in every way.
I see.
And it's modest.
It is.
It is resonant.
Oh, it is. Trust me when I say it is. So I was lucky to see one of these in the in the wood, in the flesh, in the wood, at a, it was a dealer visit that I was doing as part of a job that I was on. And we got to see some very cool previews that Takamine were going to have coming in for 2020, perhaps. It could have been just last winter that we were out there. But we saw some awesome guitar models. And then this was in the corner and I was supposed to be looking at the guitar models. And I asked the product specialist immediately about the TP10 and and how quickly I could potentially get one. So it definitely had a similar initial effect on me as it has on both of you guys.
This feels like one of those, like, not like beyond a step beyond the traditional, like Ibanez, like let's make some cool stuff and see if it sticks, you know, but like it feels like concept car kind of things where they're like, here we go with no wheels, you know, and it's just like, but you can act like I'm on a page and I could literally click add to basket. It's in stock. If I order before 3 p.m. now or 3 p.m. tomorrow, it will arrive on Tuesday.
I am very tempted by this. Do you know what I've just thought? I realized that even though we've all sort of made our own suggestions, we should have decided what won each of these categories as well. Because even though this wasn't your first category, I'm pretty sure we're all now like, yeah, this is the best fretless bass.
I mean,
this is the one.
I thought we're going to do a Gear of the Lockdown. So it gives us an indefinite period of time.
Yeah, yeah. I feel now like there's no point in me suggesting mine because this is better.
Go on. We'd love to hear it still.
Yeah, fine.
We want to hear it and then we'll go, yeah, let's talk about the TB.
So, okay, fine. What I was going to go for was kind of, I felt bad because I realized I was slightly breaking the rules. I'm not breaking the rules because it is readily available and it is very affordable, but I have gone for a slightly boutique brand in that it's still made, it's still built. A Lightwave. You guys aware of Lightwave? The VL4-2. So this is, you know, they go for, you can currently pick one up on bassdirect.co.uk if, listener, you're in the UK. I mean, I think it's cheaper to if you're outside of the EU, believe it or not. But I don't know why. I don't know why. But it's £1,500, which is a very reasonable price for a VL4 Mark II. But it's their lined fretless. Now it is, of course, as I was hinting, big fan of a piezo. So this is a solely piezo loaded, but with a massive amount of tone shaping. Indeed, you're looking at an entire four-band EQ for this, as well as love. I'm a big fan when it comes to modern instruments. Mono, what do you call them? Is it monorail? No, is monorail's the right word?
Yeah, like
I can't remember
bridge.
When it's individual bridge pieces. Yeah. That is actually a kind of a modern thing that I think works. Like having each string dealt with on its own bridge piece is a good idea. That makes sense, you know, for it is sort of for resonance wise. So lovely, yeah. Big sort of mono piece bridge, huge EQ setting. It's semi-hollow, it's chambered, it's got a lovely sort of F hole on the top. And you can get these unlined, but obviously also you can get them lined is the standard. Absolutely wonderful, gorgeous instruments. You get bass boost and cut, a mid boost and cut, a mid sweep, and then a blend, and
gotta
then a warm and cool toggle, which is pretty rad.
I'm just trying to see. I'm looking at a transparent black here.
Yeah,
I believe.
And I just, sorry, I wasn't paying attention because it wasn't about the TB10. so we can.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking about the TB10 as I talk to you about the Lightwave VL4. I'm not going to lie. No, I'm not. Also, you say you're looking at the Mark II, Joe. You're talking about the Mark II.
The VL4.
Yeah, the VL4. Well, yeah. Was it a VL4 Mark II?
Yeah, that's VL4. Right. So,
yeah.
The link to the very one I'm looking at is currently in the chat. But I just think these things are fantastic bang for their buck. I kind of, when I first tried a Lightwave, I was like, oh, you know, this, it was at a show, obviously. And yeah. I was like, yeah. This is a, it just felt like I was playing a, you know, a £4,000 instrument. You know, it was, everything about it was so, so beautiful and so perfect. And tonally, it was just so lively and incredible. And then you realize that they are, you know, £1,200 to £1,500. It's just incredible. And that piezo gives you access to all of those double bassy tones, which is kind of important to me when I'm playing a fretless. I want those tones, but I also want that sort of Jaco thing,
yeah,
that like bridge pickup tone. And this does that really, really well. You know, I've never owned one. The only fretlesses I've ever played have been, ever owned, have been either a Jazz Bass or an Ibanez Roadster, which is still, to date, as sort of people who have listened to the podcast, the Guitar Nerds podcast for a long time, my biggest regret of selling my 1979 fretless Ibanez Roadster.
Yeah.
That was a mistake. But
yeah, so I wasn't really aware that Lightwave wasn't just like that anything had not just their optical pickups. Or yeah, so
I didn't know what were the optical pickups. These are the only ones I've played, actually.
Yeah, so the optical pickups, they basically, like, at least when they first came out, and I haven't really paid that much attention to them for a long time, but like when they first came out, it was actually so like how a Morley wah uses an optical sensor as opposed to like to actually a string to rotate the pot, yeah, like, yeah, a Dunlap. So it's the same sort of thing where like it was a beam of light. And it just measured the string vibrating side to side, and it acted much like a piezo, but it was actually a light as opposed to like the pressure crystal that you have. So it wasn't the pressure pushing down on the string like a piezo. It was the actual vibration of the string moving and disrupting the beam of light that it was.
What?
Yeah, that's how like the original Lightwave pickups worked. It's like, and so like, so yeah, so it makes me, now it's, it, you know, if I didn't want to be like typey sounds on a podcast, I'd be looking this up more. But like that was always my understanding of those. And I think the Gen 1s, when they first came out, a lot of them were great until you were sort of like, one, doing an outdoor festival. I mean, it was a sealed component. So there's like the string passed through like basically this dark chamber, but it required a dark chamber. Right. To be able to measure accurately, but I've only ever heard good things about them. But it seemed like one of those things that was like such a good idea that probably just wasn't there yet, you know, like at least for yeah, me, you know, or I wasn't going to get two or three of them to play. So I did, yeah, or for like backups and stuff on, you know, like on the road and anything. So, yeah, but that's interesting. I'll have to look this up and
yeah.
Or listeners, feel free to communicate. However,
yeah, they are super cool. But I definitely think, obviously, you know, the TB10 has won this as the best fretless. Although I am currently on Reverb, hovering over the add to cart on a 1981 Ibanez Roadster bass.
Oof. Oh, this is taking you down memory lane, I think.
Oh, no. Yeah, it has. I'm really glad we didn't do best bass today, actually, because I'm hovering over an extraordinarily expensive instrument for when we talk about that. And I'm worried that talking about it when I have a computer in front of me is gonna result in a purchase, but
I feel like this fretless conversation has thrown all of us in completely splaying directions. I'm just reading more about the Lightwave here and I'm absolutely fascinated. I am potentially going to be turning up to the next podcast as an owner of a VL4, having having first seen one tonight. But this optical pickup idea, you know what it strikes me as? It literally strikes me as ingenious as MIDI. But from what you're describing, JD, you know, it sounds like the early days of MIDI technology, where you would hit a key on your on your controller and go and make a cup of tea and come back and the note would have played 5 minutes later kind of thing. So, sorry, not to in any way discount this technology, but your very real practical application of being outdoors at a festival or, you know, there's quite a lot of practical applications that maybe sound like the initial technology was perhaps a little rocky.
I mean, the idea now, right, like that I just keep thinking of like creative uses of it, of being able to be like, what if I had an LED torch or a flashlight for our North American listeners and could just take that. And I also read that on the group today.
I was going to say that didn't come up.
And then just push, you know, like what if you could shine that light down like where the, like in the pickup cavity, what would that do to the sound? Could you then use that as like some sort of controlled feedback? You know, like
possibilities. Endless.
Yeah.
So
that's, that sounds wonderful and exciting. Well, that pretty much that brings us up to actually wildly over time for this week's episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast. There you go, listener, who also listens to the Guitar Nerds podcast. Do you remember when hosts had things to talk about? Yeah, that's what's happening here on the Bass Guitar Nerds podcast. The Guitar Nerds podcast, it dried up 4 years ago, I'm telling you. But this is great. We're going to be back next week where we're going to complete our discussion of our favourite basses. So next week we've got to talk about our favourite five strings and, of course, what we will end up inevitably talking about for well over an hour. Our favourite bass of all basses that is currently available. And not, you know, not a ridiculous custom shop, but yeah, I think it's going to be good. It's going to be an interesting discussion. I'm probably going to buy something. It's going to be terrible. Awful. But yes, we'll be back next week with more of that. You can, of course, join us on all of the social medias with @GuitarNerds, or join us on Facebook on our Facebook group with facebook.com/groups/GuitarNerdsForum. We're on patreon.com/guitarnerds, where you can get loads of extra content every week. I said we'll be back next week, but we won't. We'll be back the week after. So, yes, we'll catch you then for more of this bass guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.